Fire season in Wisconsin is underway, and we're checking in with the DNR on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kant. Glad you could be here. Our Department of Natural Resources says, yes, spring, indeed. Unlike out west, spring is the most dangerous time for wildfires here, and it's after the snow has melted, before plants, trees, and grass turn green, fires can spread rapidly. Has a fire ignited near your home or your property? What was that like? What measures do you take to reduce the likelihood of a wildfire spreading? What are your buffers? 800-642-1234. Michelle Witeka is a statewide prescribed fire specialist for the DNR. Michelle, welcome to the Ideas Network. Hi, Michelle. Can you hear me? I think we're having some problem hearing Michelle. How about Mark Soss? Are you there?
Yes, I can hear you well.
Great. Mark, hi. Mark is a DNR Cooperative Area Forest Ranger who assists wildfire responders in 10 counties in southeast Wisconsin. So, Mark, let's start with you. Your agency says there are almost 1,100 wildfires in our state last year, burning more than 2,500 total acres. Is there a typical fire year or a typical wildfire?
Well, our typical fire year usually takes place in spring. So over 60% of our forest fires, our wildland fires in Wisconsin takes place in the spring. But as for a typical year, obviously last year we had almost 1,100. That's going to vary greatly just based off of the weather. With the last week or so, we've been very wet, obviously going to keep our fire numbers down. So last year was a dry spring and very close to our 10-year average in fire numbers and acreage as well.
So the biggest fire burned nearly 230 acres near Menominee Falls last April. How did that fire compare to a typical wildfire in our state?
So most of our fires in the state, the average fire is anywhere from 1 to 2.5 acres is okay. What we run on if you look at our averages again. So we do have the possibility of these large, challenging, dangerous fires, but most of the time, we're able to get to them very, very quickly. We average less than 15 minutes, either the DNR or the fire department to be on scene after somebody calls 911. So we're able to keep most of our fires very small. So occasionally we have these larger, more challenging ones.
What happens when you arrive on scene to ensure that you know what you're dealing with, that it is a wildfire?
So the planning and the thinking out process is pretty significant when you get to a fire. So we want to make sure we've got the whole picture in mind. Obviously, if you're dealing with a larger fire, if you're dealing with a fire that's 40 acres in size, if it's square, each side is a quarter mile. So it's a lot of ground to cover and a big picture to get your head wrapped around. So we want to come up with a solid game plan, make sure we keep our firefighters safe, keep the public safe, and we utilize all of the resources that we have to get a better picture. In the DNR, we heavily use aircraft. We use our air attack planes that will fly over the fire and help us get a bigger, better picture of everything. And a lot of our fire departments now have drones, or the sheriff's department has drones. So that helps to our firefighters get better eyes in the sky to see exactly where that fire is. If it's too large, you can't see the whole footprint on the ground.
Wow, so much coordination, air and ground there. Let's bring in Michelle Witeka, who is the statewide prescribed fire specialist. Hi, Michelle.
Good morning.
Good morning. So spring is also the season for prescribed burns. What is the DNR's approach to prescribed burns, and how much acreage is managed this way?
Sure. So the prescribed fire program in the state works across the state on all sorts of different habitats. Our typical year is about 250 to 300 burns. And we average around 25,000 acres burned per year.
What is the primary purpose then for these prescribed burns?
So the primary purpose that we conduct burns in Wisconsin is for the purpose of wildlife habitat maintenance or restoration. Now, we may have some secondary objectives that we also want to accomplish. There's a very small portion of burns in the state where the secondary objective for that burn would be to get rid of excess hazardous fuel. But for the most part, we are taking care of and maintaining fire dependent communities that that rely on these disturbances to keep them in the state that they are.
Why not use mechanical thinning or doing it a different way instead of burning? What is the, you know, why is burning ideal?
Sure. Yeah, that's a really good question. And we get that a lot. So there are aspects of mechanical and chemical treatments that do overlap with the benefits of prescribed burning. I mean, obviously with mechanical, you are changing the structure of the site, both horizontally and vertically. And with chemical, you are changing the composition of what's out there. But there are aspects to prescribed burning benefits that can't be achieved by these other treatments. Fire consumes vegetation and provides ash on the ground that mixes into the soil and returns all of those nutrients back into the soil to help stimulate more growth. So just that one aspect alone is not something that you can get from spraying or from mechanical. And the one thing about chemical spraying is that, you know, you're still putting chemicals into the ground, regardless of what kind of chemical it is, it's still going there. And a lot of the herbicides that we can use are not as targeted as we would really desire. And so you may go out there to spray something, but you may be inadvertently spraying something else that you want. And so, you know, if a native species is supposed to be there, you run fire through there and it will actually be benefited from it. And so, yeah, I guess the solid short answer to that is that fire provides benefits that you just cannot get with these other pieces of equipment.
With these other means. Fire. Yes.
Right, right.
Well, let me reintroduce you both. Michelle Wateka there is statewide prescribed fire specialist for the DNR. Mark Soss is a DNR cooperative area forest manager who assists wildfire responders in the southeast part of our state as we look at fire season and hear your questions about wildfires, about prescribed burns, 800-642-1234. Mark, you know, you have helped put out wildfires and served as a burn boss leading crews doing controlled burns. And I'm wondering, how do fire managers ensure that the fire will not escape in these controlled burns? Because after all, it is wildfire season at the same time.
Exactly. So we put a ton of prep and planning into our prescribed burn program. So we've got and thorough written plans for all of them. And then the biggest on the ground difference is we've got our fire breaks, our containment lines. We know where that fire is going to start and stop and making sure those are solid and well patrolled. We have all of our equipment and resources there, obviously, before we start. So once we have that game plan and everything laid out and we have great solid fire breaks, we're very confident that between ignition patterns and our staff and resources on scene, we can do great work for the habitat and keep that fire right where we desire it to be.
Can you explain what a containment line would be or what a fire break would be? Would it be a road or some other, you know, what would that be?
So sometimes our fire breaks are roads. It is basically bare mineral soil or another fuel that cannot burn. So roads are great. We can burn right up to service roads, county roads, whatever it might be. We also put in rotivated brakes. So we'll take a big, basically rototiller behind a farm tractor, and we can turn that soil into bare mineral soil as well. So our fire brakes are going to be anything where that fuel stops and that fire is going to stop as well.
We have a pair of state DNR officials on fire suppression and controlled burns in this fire season. Mark Soss, their DNR Cooperative Area Forest Manager, and Michelle Wateka, prescribed burn specialist for the state. What makes Wisconsin wildfires different from wildfires out west? Have you seen a prescribed burn and wondered how it did keep contained and under control? What steps do you take to prevent fires when out camping or in the forest? 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with the DNR on the Ideas Network. We're talking about spring fire season with the DNR amid a drought covering most of the state. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The DNR says wildfires can start anywhere, especially where people live, and it's people who cause almost all wildfires, most often by burning debris in the spring. What questions are in your mind about wildfires or prescribed burns? Still time, 800-642-1234. We have the DNR's Mark Sauce and Michelle Wateka. They're with us for about 10 more minutes. I want to ask both of you about what impact drought has on both of your work. Starting with you, Michelle, much of the state experiencing drought, as you know, and the drought monitor saying the southern third is experiencing moderate drought conditions, rest of the state abnormally dry or normal. What does that mean in terms of controlled burns?
That's a really good question, and it's something that we most definitely had to work with last year. One of the biggest watch-outs or concerns that we think about when we're in a drought is what are the fuel types that are now probably more receptive to fire than usual? So what kinds of, when we're talking about larger logs, when we're talking about peat marsh, that usually doesn't have an issue with fire. Well, drought can change those things on the subsurface levels. And so when we are working in drought, we have to be cognizant of if we're working with peat, we have the, if we don't do things the way that we need to, we can have issues with ongoing peat fires at that site. We can also have issues with, like I said, heavier fuels like downed trees, which usually take a really long time to dry out and aren't usually receptive to fire. Well, at this point they are in the game and they are a factor. And then, so in summary, it's mostly just holding issues, being mm-hmm. able to maintain control of the burn and acknowledging that, you know, fire is not just going to run past these places. You actually do need to take care there. The other thing that really impacts us is that drought can have a major stress on trees within the burn unit. And if there are things like oaks and pine that we'd like to not only have them subsist, but also regenerate, we want to make sure that we're not burning too dry in order to damage those trees and cause additional stress. So those are the two things that we think.
Mark, what do you think about? Do you see the straight line correlation? Does more drought mean our state is more likely to experience wildfires, or is there not such a straight line there?
Fairly straight line, and just like what Michelle was saying, when your ground is drier, we have less moisture in the ground. Obviously, as that drought code increases, there's less moisture in the soil to keep the fuels that are laying on the ground wetter. So you think of those big logs, tipped over trees, things like that. So just like Michelle was saying, it is going to, these fires, it's not really going to affect too much how quickly they spread. They're going to spread at the same rate, but now where it would pass over a larger log on the ground, for example, now that log is going to be burning because there's next to nothing for moisture in it for it to absorb off the ground. So what it does is it makes our job truly extinguishing these fires, and we call it mopping up after you get containment, making sure that fire is completely out. It increases the time committed by our fire departments and our DNR staff substantially when we have to look at every single piece of downed wood or debris in the forest now because it is all receptive to fire. So just like what Michelle was saying, it's the same thing on the suppression side.
You have to be such attention to detail there. I want to turn to burn permits, Mark. You know, residents can get free permits to burn brush. How important are burn permits for preventing out-of-control fires?
They're very important. They're one of our biggest tools to doing that. So I would have the listeners go to the DNR's website, dnr.wi.gov, and check out and just search a keyword fire to find out where they are in the state. We have three different areas of forest fire protection in the DNR. We have our intensive, extensive, and then our cooperative areas. So anywhere in our intensive or extensive, we require a DNR burning permit. Last year, they are free. Last year, we issued just under 48,000 of those. So those are changed every day based on the weather, how hot, how dry, how windy, factors like that. And it allows people, it tells them if and when they can burn debris. So that yard cleanup type of burning that folks are doing this spring. So over a third of our fires usually are caused by debris burning. So if we can limit burning to safer times of the day, usually in the evening from 6 p.m. until midnight or during wetter periods, that's going to substantially reduce our risk of those fires escaping.
Wait, you said over a third of the wildfires are caused by these burning of brush and other things?
Correct. Yep. Everybody wants to get out in the spring, make their yard look nice after a long winter. So raking up pine needles or leaves or whatever, the last sticks that came down. And that's where those beautiful spring days when folks are out burning, it's nice to work in the yard. Those are unfortunately the same days where fires spread very quickly usually.
And so those can really get out of control if you're not watching them and paying attention to when you can be burning on what days and times.
Correct. So this is, this type of work is a chore. So that's campfires for cooking or warming. If you're going to sit around and roast marshmallows or enjoy a campfire with friends or family, those we do not regulate at all in the DNR. Those are allowed at any time because that's something that people enjoy doing and they're going to be there and be paying attention to it and put it out like Smokey Bear tells you to. It's the debris burning, which is a chore. When you're doing that, you're in the garage, you're cleaning up, doing something else, and you're probably not paying as much attention to it as you should. So between the yard cleanup, and it's a chore. Not everybody's going to be attending it the way they should. So that's where most of our fires, a lot of our fires start in the spring.
Talking with Mark Soss, DNR Cooperative Area Forest Ranger, assists wildfire responders. Michelle Wateka, statewide prescribed fire specialist, taking your calls here with the DNR on prescribed burns and wildfire season, 800-642-1234. Michelle, I'm wondering, when you do a prescribed burn and carefully thought out, what does happen to all the critters in that area or the wildlife in that area?
Yeah, that's also a really good question. And it's totally understandable that someone would ask. A lot of these animals that choose to make their home in a fire-dependent ecosystem, and when I say that, I mean things like prairies, emergent marshes, oak savannas, oak barrens and pine barrens, those are all fire dependent. And the wildlife species that live there have adapted to experiencing these occasional disturbances. And so what typically happens is you'll have burrowing animals that utilize those burrows. And it's almost like the African savanna where there's a watering hole in a drought. You have burrowing animals that will share burrows with other species because it's, an emergency situation. You have animals that will fly. You have animals that will run. Ultimately, there is a temporary disturbance to that site. But, you give that site a matter of simple weeks to recover, and wildlife are already going back to utilize it. And we make sure that, when we're burning, we are burning in a mosaic on the landscape. So even though we've burned this particular unit on a property, right adjacent to that is similar habitat. And so there's always somewhere else to go. And like I've said in other interviews, I've gone back to do wildlife surveys in other jobs immediately post-fire, where things are still smoking on the ground, and wildlife are already coming back into that unit to forage for burned insects with birds, to forage in the ash with deer and turkey. So they're very used to seeing fire. They know how to escape, and they know also how to utilize it after that.
What about the pollution from the smoke of a prescribed burn? Is there any way to limit the impact on communities?
Absolutely. And so for the last 2 years, especially with the pandemic concerns and air quality and especially people being comfortable to breathe, we have pretty strict standards in place on what air quality levels we can burn at, what smoke dispersal levels we can burn at. We do look all the way downwind every time we send smoke down in that direction. And we try to pick the direction and the day that's going to cause the least amount of impact on basically civilized areas. Mm-hmm. If there are things that are very sensitive, let's see, nursing homes, schools, hospitals, airports, we tend to just not burn in that direction. Highways are another one. So smoke management is a huge component of our burn planning. And so, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of days where we could have the perfect prescription line up for us, but if we don't have that good smoke dispersal, we're just not doing the fire.
Well, thank you so much for joining us and giving us a sense of your work. Michelle Wateka, statewide prescribed fire specialist for the DNR. Mark Soss, DNR Cooperative Area Forest Manager, assisting wildfire responders in the southeast part of our state. Stay with us. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now with our Wisconsin Peers producer, Maureen McCollum, with a story about identity in the real and digital worlds.
Anyone who uses social media presents a somewhat edited version of themselves. They're selective about what they post, they use photo filters, or they create cartoon-like stylized avatars as their profile image. WPR's Emily Ralph, a trans woman, used her Bitmoji avatar in her coming out process, slowly making changes in the digital realm before they became Emily's physical reality. Over time, Emily began to wonder what the experience was like for her Bitmoji on the other side of the digital divide. This story comes from the perspective of that Bitmoji.
I was born or created or whatever, maybe 6 of your years ago, but time here is different and too hard to explain. As I understand it, my world is part of what you call the internet. It's often loud and chaotic.
Killing it!
Celebrating Wednesday here is like your 4th of July or something.
Hey, it's hump day.
Yeah!
Our understanding is that we're a kind of reflection of you. And I know that because when you look at me, I see you too. Though separate beings, we are connected by creation. Not only are our images bonded together, but also emotion, thoughts, and our sense of self. That's how I first knew. I was created as male, but that was wrong. Here, I'm alone, but mostly because you haven't used the connect with friends feature. I'm not lonely, though. I have TV and newspapers, and there's an excellent public radio station.
Next, it's the cultural significance of Wednesday, but first, it's your birthday! Yay!
Mostly, though, I watch you. In my early days, as you made changes to my hair or clothes, I felt this overwhelming sadness pouring from you, like from an old, cracked, and moss-covered dam about to give way. I knew because you did that you were not made the right way, and that pain was bigger than the sky. Then one night while I was sleeping, you made a change to my physical appearance settings, and I was suddenly whole, suddenly fully formed, and it was wonderful beyond words. Around this time, you began using me as your representative image in all kinds of places. I was in Twitter, which I'm guessing is why you have me standing next to a dumpster fire. I appeared in Facebook, in some kind of step tracking app. Then slowly you brought me to where you work through Zoom, Google Meet, and Slack. You made me your face in your world, and I began to understand why. I knew that for you, the thing that was wrong was orders of magnitude more complicated than changing a setting, but that me being there first would make it easier. Over time, you made my hair longer and added cute earrings and makeup, and I saw you were changing too. At first, it was a smile, then your clothes, then something with your face and lasers, which sounds scary, like we use lasers in our extravagant It's Wednesday celebrations. It made you smile even more, so it must be worth it. From my place as the image in your health app, I see appointments with specialty doctors who help change your physical form to align with gender settings. As we draw closer together, I feel you will soon overtake me, that my assignment of being there first will come to an end, and soon it will be your pretty face on Slack, Zoom, Facebook, and Twitter. I am excited for you and proud of you, and I will always be here for you. But now, it's your time.
That was producer Emily Ralph's Bitmoji. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now to the COVID vaccine, as children under five are still not eligible for protection. Moderna announced plans last month to seek emergency use authorization of their COVID vaccine for babies and toddlers after seeing promising results in a clinical study. Do you have a young one in this age group? What do you want to ask the infectious disease physician about COVID vaccines? It's 800-642-1234 to join in. Dr. Nasia Safdar is Associate Dean for Clinical Trials at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and Research Director of the new Wisconsin Medicine Institute for Clinical Trials. That's a partnership between UW-Madison and UW-Health. Dr. Safdar, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. So what is the status of a COVID vaccine and the development for children under five?
You know, I think what we know at this point is that there's several additional trials underway. And I think that the results of that will determine what eventually happens with a vaccine. I don't doubt that it will eventually happen, but I understand that everyone must be very frustrated that it hasn't already occurred.
I think you've heard so many parents probably say, what is taking so long in the clinical trial process? Can you take us inside that process and what that might be like?
So in general, you know, there is no substitute for a clinical trial for determining the effectiveness of a vaccine, especially for something that we really don't know much about and can't really go by already known knowledge about it. So when these trials are done, the focus is really on two things. You know, one is safety and the other is effectiveness. And they're both important. And of course, safety is the primary concern with anything that's new and uncertain, especially in children and especially in smaller children who are a very vulnerable group because they're still developing and you really can't extrapolate adult data to that in children.
Oh, so you would, I would imagine then it's really difficult to find the right dosage for babies and for toddlers.
That's exactly right. So ultimately, you know, at some level, one has to make one's best guess estimate based on what you believe to be the right dose. But as we saw, and it is quite possible that that may have to be revised.
What will the Food and Drug Administration take into consideration before it does approve a vaccine for children under five?
So I think still those two things and a very careful scrutiny of those. So the primary one is safety, and that, as best as we can tell from what has been published or written about in these trials, is that safety appears to be very good, which is highly reassuring, of course. And then the other is effectiveness. Then you wonder, you know, effectiveness of what? Effectiveness against the infection or effectiveness of preventing hospitalization? And fortunately, you know, with COVID cases having dropped in the US and elsewhere, some of the outcomes have not occurred, which is good in some respects, but then also that doesn't help in determining the effectiveness of the vaccine against the severe outcomes.
Right. And I think if I'm hearing this right, is that you have to really weigh the side effects of the vaccine versus the effectiveness of, say, you know, keeping that child, you know, safer from the Omicron variant or another variant of COVID, not having the side effects outweigh the safety and effectiveness against that variant.
That's right. And so, you know, if a vaccine is effective, if it's highly effective, then one can make the argument that, well, you know, we're in the midst of a surge, we need to do this vaccine, and then we'll follow carefully and monitor for the side effects, as happened earlier in the pandemic. And now I think the bar is somewhat higher. We really want to make sure that what you're delivering to little children is effective without exposing them to any untoward effects.
So the CDC found that there were record numbers of children under five who had been hospitalized during the Omicron surge. But CDC has since said that nearly all people can safely stop wearing masks in public indoor spaces, even young children in schools. So how should parents with young unvaccinated children negotiate that, navigate safety and risk in this time without a vaccine?
You know, I think ultimately it comes down to your own perception about how risk averse you would like to be. And the parents of small children are often very risk averse, understandably. So I think even though it's not a requirement anymore that people wear masks in public places, the parents of small children may still advise them to do so. And of course, the very small kids might not be able to do it. But over the age of two, most children are able to. Of course, it's a hard thing for them to do because they have uncomplainingly done this throughout the pandemic.
Yes.
But I think until we have a vaccine, especially those little kids with chronic conditions that puts them at risk, I would still encourage the use of masks.
I really appreciate your word uncomplainingly, because I can see that in my children who just see it now as routine. Get the mask out the door. Get another mask in the backpack, you know, as a backup. They do it automatically.
They are definitely the heroes of this pandemic.
Let's look at the age groups, the approved age groups here. And, you know, first it was kids age 12 through 18, then 5 to 11. Next up are the under fives. But how do these age divisions happen? And you know, how do these groupings happen?
So it has to do, you know, some of it is a little arbitrary, but the other rationale for doing it is that you're looking at development of the immune system, you're looking at body mass distribution of the vaccine, and so those things are important when it comes to determining the dosage and in determining how many series you might need or how many doses in a series you might need. And so many other vaccine trials over the years have used the same age strata, and so I think that's pretty well embedded at this point.
With these age groups for the children, the 12 to 18, 5 to 11, what are you seeing in terms of uptake of COVID vaccine, and how is that going?
You know, I think in the earlier days when it was first authorized, I think there was a lot of excitement and the uptake was brisk. And since then, I think it has somewhat leveled off. And of course, there's a lot of variation around the country in when and how people have chosen to get it. Nonetheless, I think, you know, uptake has been steady. It would be great if it was even more accelerated. But in the older children, especially, I think parents were really waiting to have this. And once it was available, they did make use of it.
We have infectious disease physician Nasia Safdar stays with us on COVID vaccines, children, the latest on COVID clinical trials, as she heads up research for the Wisconsin Medicine Institute for Clinical Trials. What do you wonder about clinical trials and the various stages and the process to them? Would you participate in one? Has someone in your life participated in a clinical trial? What was that like? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a moment with Dr. Safdar here on the Ideas Network. We're getting up to speed on COVID vaccines, clinical trials, the process involved to get a COVID vaccine for the youngest children under five. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The National Institutes of Health, the NIH, announced last week that it's kicking off a clinical trial evaluating a second COVID booster for adults. And the study includes multiple variant vaccines. The NIH says adults interested in joining the study should visit clinicaltrials.gov and search for the COVAIL trial. It's not recruiting yet, as I last checked. What do you wonder about clinical trials? Have you been in one? What was that like? Still time, 800-642-1234. Dr. Nasia Safdar is Associate Dean for Clinical Trials at UW School of Medicine and Public Health, Research Director at the Wisconsin Medicine Institute for Clinical Trials. Dr. Safdar, I was on the NIH's clinical trials portal site yesterday. I was amazed. I was blown away by the sheer number of COVID-related clinical trials that are happening around the world or ones that are about to begin. Can you comment on this perhaps exploding research area?
I think it's been very heartening to see that people have come together in these large collaborative groups in a very short period of time. And I think it's a recognition early on of the fact that despite everything else that people were doing to stop transmission, like distancing, like masking, not leaving their homes and so on, you know, those measures are not really sustainable. And the thing that was going to bring this pandemic to a slow crawl or ideally to a halt was going to be the vaccines. So I think the investment and the commitment, and of course the participants without whom there can be no trials, all reflect that.
Oh, and the collaboration between institutions and the federal government, I mean, there has got to be an immense amount of collaboration here between scientists.
That is probably the silver lining of this pandemic, is the information sharing and the fact that people really took the time to learn from each other to avoid repeating some of the trials that we had done and to really focus on high impact, high yield things that could really change the way this pandemic unfolded.
So back in September, you started your role as Associate Dean for Clinical Trials and the Research Director of the Wisconsin Medicine Institute for Clinical Trials. Can you tell us what is the focus for UW Clinical Trials and what is it looking at specifically in the area of COVID?
So the focus for the clinical trials is really to diversify and to broaden and deepen the portfolio of clinical trials that happen at SMPH and UW Health, whether these are partnerships with industry, investigator-initiated, federally sponsored, you know, they run the whole spectrum of those trials. And of course, being a large medical care center for much of the state and beyond, and a large academic institution, it's a unique opportunity to partner the talent that exists here with the enthusiasm of the participants that really have been seeking opportunities to join clinical trials. We want to make sure that anybody that has an interest in it in a clinical trial is able to. So removing barriers to access is going to be a really important aspect of it. And ultimately, I think, you know, whatever the patient needs are, what the conditions are that need intervention and innovation, that's where the clinical trials will be.
And when you say diversify and deepen clinical trials, is that meaning that you really want to do more clinical trials and in getting into more areas than what you are currently?
That, and then also expanding within the areas that we already are. You know, the major health, chronic health conditions that affect the population and the number and the type of trials should reflect that. So that includes cancer, cardiac conditions, strokes, you know, in this case with the pandemic, COVID. And then the participants in the trials should really be reflective of the population that will eventually be using this product once it's approved. So making sure that adequate representation is there. And in the past, you know, clinical trials have not really paid heed to that and has not been a focus. But now it's really not possible to run a clinical trial without good representation of all the populations that will eventually benefit from the product that results from it.
How difficult is it to get the number and diversity of participants that you need to run a clinical trial?
Well, I think that's really the linchpin of every clinical trial. You know, you can't have any results, you really can't make any progress unless you have the participants. So we're very grateful to the Wisconsin population that has come out in droves to participate in these really important trials. There is no substitute to determining the effectiveness and the efficacy of a new product other than clinical trial participation. But for any clinical trial, that is the single most important thing that they must focus on is the recruitment and retention of participants.
Late last year, UW Health was involved in testing a Moderna vaccine for children 6 months to 12 years. What did you learn through that trial and other COVID-related vaccine trials?
You know, for most COVID-related vaccine trials, I think the big thing that we have found is that there's been a lot of interest in participation, mm-hmm. which has been great. It has allowed results to come out far quicker than they would have otherwise. I think a lot of research infrastructure evolved during the pandemic in response to some of the restrictions. You know, for instance, consenting participants became remote in many instances where the trial was able to be done that way, really made it easier for people to join. Some of the trials that the NIH is running, there is no need for an in-person visit. The drug is dispensed by mail. The consenting is done remotely. So those things, I think, have made it easier for people who otherwise would find it hard to participate.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Nasia Safdar about clinical trials. She's an associate dean for clinical trials at UW School of Medicine and Public Health, research director of the new Wisconsin Medicine Institute for Clinical Trials. Join in at 800-642-1234. So what is it like to work with the big pharmaceutical companies on these clinical trials, Moderna and Pfizer? And what is that working relationship like, especially with these COVID vaccine trials?
Well, I think, you know, they've taken the lead in making sure that the vaccines are developed, that trials are done in a timely manner, and that the results are peer reviewed and publicly displayed and so on. So I think that within that infrastructure of transparency, of safety, of paying really close attention to diversity and engagement of participants, you know, without that partnership, we would still, I think, be in the early days of the pandemic where, if we remember, things were pretty, pretty terrible.
I remember talking with you in those early days, and there were so many unknowns. Do you feel like there is a clear picture now for what we're dealing with COVID-19?
Well, I think a lot clearer, but certainly not everything is known. And, you know, viruses have a way of surprising us. So, for instance, even though we can predict and model what the fall will look like, it could entirely be that we would be surprised yet again. I think the good thing is that no matter what happens going forward, at least we have a robust array of tools. You know, of course, there's a vaccine, but in addition, there are also therapeutics that can be used in people who are either hospitalized or not sick enough to be hospitalized, but sick enough to need treatment. So those things are all new. And since they've come about, it has led me to be a lot more reassured.
Do you imagine that there will be a need for a second booster in the fall?
You know, it wouldn't surprise me if that was the case. I think we'll have to see what sort of iteration of the virus and what variant emerges. But it would not surprise me if that was the case.
In the area of therapeutics and someone who is hospitalized with COVID, you've seen advancements there. Can you explain what is most promising when your loved one is faced with this hospitalization and fighting COVID?
You know, sometimes I think that's another thing we learned from this pandemic is that you really have to retest and repurpose medications that exist for other indications to see whether they might be helpful for this. And steroids, of course, changed mortality in COVID when given to patients who were hospitalized. So very old medication used for a whole host of indications and also worked for COVID. In addition, there are a lot of other novel medications that were tested in trials found to be effective, although the spectrum of effectiveness has varied from group to group. But there's a whole array of them now that are used for hospitalized patients. And then there are two that are available for people who are not hospitalized, who have had a short duration of illness, but have risks that will make it, you know, difficult for them to cope with severe COVID should they get it, such as those who are immunocompromised. And so, yeah, you know, using those medications is going to be really important.
Dr. Safdar, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Nasia Safdar, Associate Dean for Clinical Trials at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.